I'm supposed to read that?
No,
not yet. Okay.
Can you even see what you're fighting for? Bloodlust and a holy war. Listen up, hear the patriots shout.
Times are changing.
In the end, choice was clear. Take a shot in the face of fear. Fist up in the fiery light.
Times are changing. Oh, do you believe that you can walk on water? Oh, do you believe that you can win this fight tonight?
Look at the sky, see a dying star. White lies, it's a man on fire. Making love with the devil hurts.
Times are changing. A thin line, the whole truth. The far right, the left view.
Breaking all those promises made.
Times are changing. Oh, oh, do you believe that you can walk on water? Oh, oh, do you believe that you can win this fight tonight? Oh, oh, do you believe that you can walk on water? Oh, oh, do you believe that you can win this fight tonight?
Do you believe?
Walk on water.
Do you believe?
Walk on water. Walk on water.
Do you believe?
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 Walk on water.
Oh, oh. Do you believe that you can walk on water? Oh. Do you believe that you can win this fight tonight? Oh, oh, do you believe that you can walk on water? Oh, oh, do you believe that you can win this fight tonight?
Thank you. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Community Church of Hendricks County. My name is Dave Cravatta, and the song that I chose tonight was Walk on Water, written by 30 Seconds to Mars. I was joined by Monica Smith and Ryan Turnipseed. Thank you both very much. And also a special thanks to Annie Johnson for supplying us with a much-needed battery before we started. We are a progressive congregation consisting of people of many beliefs, some with a religious background, some with none, some who believe in a God, and some who do not. Our beliefs are diverse, but inclusive. We have no shared creed, but instead a shared covenant, including our seven principles, which you'll find posted on the wall. Whatever your faith, whomever you love, we welcome you with all your truths and your doubts, your worries and your hopes. We are a community that embraces freedom of thought, where people come together to encourage each other to spiritual growth that makes for peace, ethical living, and community service. During these Chautauqua sessions, a collection plate will not be passed, but donations are graciously accepted. Donation plates are located on the back table near the entrance and on the small table near the door leading to our fellowship hall. If you have any questions about our church, feel free to explore the literature on the tables. You can also speak with any of us wearing a name tag. I should have one. I don't. But you can talk to me too. And now I turn things over to Barbara Whitehead, who will serve as our moderator this evening.
You know, it seems like I have a lot here, but this is 24 font, so I can read it. It's not that much. Anyway, welcome to Hendricks County's Chautauqua. I'm Barbara Whitehead, today's moderator. And before I introduce our speaker, I would like to say a brief word about tomorrow's day of commemoration, Memorial Day. For as long as there's been war, there have been remembrances of war dead. Think of Antigone wanting so desperately to bury her brother. Memorial Day is in that tradition of veneration. Given that it's an American holiday, however, its history naturally is clouded in conflict. Different towns all claim to be the first to have a Memorial Day. All the dates are different for the earliest commemorations, and so there's this huge controversy. And rather than rehearse that, I thought I'd share with you some facts about Memorial Day that are more in keeping with the true spirit of the day. To begin, the original date of the holiday was May 30th, a day chosen, one author claims, because of course there's a dispute about this, but it was chosen because it was not the anniversary of any particular battle. Others claim that the date was chosen because it was the optimal day for flowers to be in bloom in the north. Either explanation seems appropriately poetic for this day. The United States National Park Service attributes the beginning of the practices of Memorial Day, originally called Decoration Day, to the ladies, and it's been women who have been very much behind Memorial Day for obvious reasons. They are the ones left behind. But the practices of Memorial Day began with the ladies of Columbus, Mississippi. On April 25th, 1866, women in Columbus laid flowers on the graves of both the Union and Confederate dead in the city's Friendship Cemetery. This recognition of all the war dead, regardless of the side they fought for, sets the right tone for this day, I think. 2 years later, May 5th, 1868, General John Logan, Commander-in-Chief of the Grand Army of the Republic, issued a proclamation calling for Decoration Day to be observed annually and nationwide, which it has been ever since, the name changing from Decoration Day to Memorial Day, although Memorial Day was not declared the official name until 1967, which seems very recent since that's in my life. And, you know, things like that should be back in the past. Anyway, I like to read a poem on these days, and I was searching for a poem to honor the dead on Memorial Day, and there are so many poems, but quite a lot of them are very martial in spirit, amplifying the cause and not so much the individual. But I found this one talking about those left behind. It's Perhaps, written by Vera Brittain. She dedicated the poem to her fiancé, Roland Aubrey Layton, who was killed in 1915 at the age of 20 by a sniper just 4 months after she had accepted his marriage proposal. So Perhaps by Vera Brittain. Perhaps someday the sun will shine again, and I shall see that still the skies are blue, and feel once more I do not live in vain, although bereft of you. Perhaps the golden meadows at my feet will make the sunny hours of spring seem gay, and I shall find the white May blossoms sweet, though you have passed away. Perhaps the summer woods will shimmer bright, and crimson roses once again be fair, and autumn harvest fields a rich delight, although you are not there. Perhaps someday I shall not shrink in pain to see the passing of the dying year, and listen to Christmas songs again, although you cannot hear. But though kind time may many joys renew, there is one greatest joy I shall not know again, because my heart, for loss of you, was broken long ago. So, just a remembrance for Memorial Day. Today's speaker is Bill Breeden, one of those true individuals you'd want to just sit and listen to for hours as they talked about everything they've done in their life. What an amazing, fantastic life Bill has had. Truck driver and 2016 Democratic candidate for the Indiana State Legislature. Unitarian Universalist minister, peace and social justice activist, and subject of a 1994 PBS documentary. And of course, Jailbird, in the name of noble causes. In a 2014 Bloom magazine article, Bill made one of the pithiest comments that I've read about the human condition, one that really resonates. If the human species joins the rank of the extinct, if there's a post-mortem, he said, I think the conclusion will be that our brains were too big and our hearts too small. Brains too big, hearts too small. Something to think about, especially as Bill's talk today looks at how we determine the greatness of a nation. Please welcome Bill Breeden as he reflects on the question, whence cometh greatness?
Well, thank you for that introduction. I'd forgotten that Bloom magazine. I'm glad to see that somebody reads it in these days. It's good to be here. We realized that I'd missed my turn. It's been a while since I've been to Danville. I used to speak here back in the 90s, once a month for several years. I guess it had been so long that I forgot where I turned and ended up in Greencastle before I realized I'd missed the turn, and so staggered around with Siri's help and got to the right road. And there were too many law-abiding citizens for me to get here 4 minutes early instead of 4 minutes late, but that's the way it goes. Well, I wasn't expecting to speak on Memorial Day. I had actually agreed to a later day this year in your program, but Phil called and asked, because of complications with the schedule, if I would take this day, and I said yes. Let me just say that Memorial Day has always been tough for me. Not always. In my later life, and my adult life, I should say, it's been tough for me, because I'm a pacifist, and I make no apologies for that. I used to, when I was a teenager, I found that I couldn't fight. My twin brother, my mother and father, by the way, had three sets of twins and three singles. So we came from a large family in southern Indiana, and I grew up with three brothers, older brothers in the military, one of them serving in Vietnam. And yet, when I was on the bus as a child and things would happen and I would be picked on or hit, I always found it impossible to hit back, not out of any altruistic thing or theological thing, but simply found it puzzling. It took me too long to figure out why I'd been hit. And by that time, my twin brother jumped in and fought the fight for me. And that went for a long time through my life. Or through my early childhood and teenage years, and I can remember literally crying myself to sleep at night, thinking I wasn't much of a man because I couldn't fight my own fights. And it really wasn't until I was 20 years old and read Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five. After finishing that book, I said, I'm thankful to be a pacifist. By accident, I guess. The Children's Crusade convinced me that pacifism was what I wanted to be. So from that time on, and especially after entering the ministry good Lord, long time ago, first in the Christian Church, Disciples of Christ, and then with the Unitarian Universalists when I returned to the ministry in the year 2000, or in the 90s with you all. Since that time, Memorial Day's always been difficult, because I don't want to denigrate veterans in any way, shape, or form. I had three brothers who were veterans, one who served in Nam. I had an Uncle Carl who died. In fact, I'll tell you a brief story about that to begin with. I'm glad you have a clock here. How long did I go here? I know she said you want to listen to me for hours, but I don't want you to. It's hard telling where I'll go. I remember in 1962, I believe it was, maybe 61. A young teenager, I was, you know, wanting to be tough. I had my hair like James Dean, as we all did, and I couldn't drink, smoke, or chew. We didn't do that in those days. We were Nazarenes, and couldn't go out with girls who do either. But we were gathered around a 1957 Chevy at the filling station in the middle of Odin, Indiana, Pete Merrifield's station, and all the tough guys, the older boys, were around there looking at this engine. He had just the night before outrun my brother on the quarter mile on the two-lane blacktop drag strip we had near Ragglesville. And my brother's 55 Ford had been the hottest thing around until Charlie souped up this 57 Chevy. Charlie had come home from Korea. He was a young boy in Korea. By this time he was in his 30s. And he shook so bad he couldn't drink in an open glass without spilling it. And my mom always told me that was from the war. But Charlie was working at Merrifield Station, and all the young guys were standing there bragging about it. He was telling us about the engine and everything. Pete Merrifield, the guy who owned the station, was pumping. You remember when they pumped gas at gas stations and wash your windshields and things like that? He was having to do all that because we were all standing around this 57 Chevy. And finally he got aggravated because Charlie wasn't doing his job, and we were all just a bunch of boys, and he come walking over, "You're just a bunch of punks. Bunch of punk boys want to be men." He said, "What this world needs is another good war." And I thought that was the coolest thing I ever heard. And I, all the way home, we lived about 5 miles out of Odin, and I hitchhiked home. We hitchhiked a lot in those days. And all the way home, when I was walking the gravel road a mile from the pavement after I got out and walk home, I was practicing the same inflection. I dropped the goddamn. He used goddamn, and I couldn't use that at our supper table, but I thought, man, what this country needs is a good war, another good war. So I came in to sit down at the supper table, and Mom and Dad and Carl and Daryl were there, and they were talking about politics. I think President Kennedy or someone like that, and I sit there eating for a little bit, and then I just piped up and said, "Well, what this country needs is another good war." And my mother, who was one of the mildest women you'd want to meet, I can't ever really remember her whipping me or anything, but I mean, after you have three sets of twins and three singles, you get to the younger set of twins, you're worn out anyway. I mean, Pappy didn't even whip us because I think he was worn out. But Mom looked at me as sternly as she's ever looked at me, and she said, "Billy, there's no such thing as a good war." I slammed my silverware down, took off up the room, and walked down, stomping up the stairs of that old farmhouse, and Pappy hollered and saying, "Get back down here, get back down here." And I just stomped on up to bed and sit there in my bed, and was hurt. Couldn't believe that Mom didn't understand that I was getting smarter, that I was getting older, that I was a teenager now or very near it, and that I had something to say. And later on, as I lay there, I heard Mom coming up the stairs. And I pretended to be asleep. She sat down on the bed and put her arms around me. And she said, "Billy, I didn't mean to hurt your feelings. But," she said, "I want you to know why I said there is no such thing as a good war." She said, "You remember, you know that your brother Carl, my next older brother, the one closest to Daryl and I, was named after my younger brother Carl. Have I ever told you how Carl died?" I said, "No." She said, "Well, World War II was coming to an end. Mother had to raise her younger siblings because her mother got what they called in those days brain fever, and they didn't have the medicine to bring her temperature down, and she had to be put in an asylum. So Mother had raised her, I think, three young siblings, and Carl was her youngest brother. And Carl, they got a letter from Carl at the end of the war. The war was just winding up, and said, "I'm boarding the ship to come home. I should see you in a few weeks." They didn't hear from him again, but a few weeks later, they got another letter from the Pentagon. And the letter said, that your brother Carl Breeden was coming back from the European theater, returning from the war, when they met a hospital ship and he volunteered to go back that was going to pick up wounded soldiers in Europe. And that ship hit a mine and sunk. And my mother looked at me and she said, "That's why I'm telling you, there's no such thing as a good war. No such thing as a good war." And perhaps that was a forerunner to my understanding of the value of being a pacifist. I don't know. It took me longer than that to understand it. Glenda and I spent a few years ago when I was a minister at the Bloomington U Church. I had six months at Vatico, five, I think. And we went to Mexico, bought a Buick for $500, and a week later left to Mexico and drove it 8,000 miles and kept it another 5 or 6 months before it broke down. But I spent a lot of time driving through Mexico. We drove down through Chiapas and the Yucatan. The thing that struck me most about Mexico is I never saw one single monument to war. Not a single one, all the way down through there. I never saw one monument of a soldier. I never saw one monument of an airplane, a fighter, a bomber, nothing like that. All of their monuments as you drive on through Mexico are laborers. They're laborers, orange pickers, seamen. You saw these sailors and things like this. I started looking for them in town halls and as we drove through villages. I started looking because I was stunned that there was no monuments to war. It's not that they haven't had wars. It's that they didn't want to make it something to be worshipped, I think. So I want to be very clear that I do not denigrate veterans at all. I think the very best thing we could do for veterans is to never have war again. And that's what we should be working for. I want to add another first Memorial Day story. In 1996, David Blight, Yale professor of history, was trying to find this path, this historical thread about Memorial Day, and ran across a letter written and reported in the New York Times. The first Memorial Day, he says, was organized by freed black slaves less than a month after the Confederacy surrendered in 1865 in Charlottesville, North Carolina. In 1996, he found that there was a racetrack in Charlottesville that had been used as a prison camp for Union soldiers, where 260 soldiers were buried in a mass grave. And on May 1st, 1865, a crowd of 10,000 people, mostly freed slaves, staged a parade around that racetrack. It was a huge racetrack that they had commandeered as a prison. And exhumed the bodies of those 260 Union soldiers and reburied them in graves and celebrated their lives. These days, we celebrate Memorial Day with jet fighters flying over the 500-mile race in a missing man formation. These days, we celebrate Memorial Day with military parades. These days, we don't think about war in the way that we should. Now, Chautauqua, if you look at the history of Chautauqua, is basically an adult education program started by a United Methodist minister, a Methodist, probably not United Methodist that time, a Methodist minister, and spread all across the country. They did them. They had traveling shows, sometimes music, sometimes dance, sometimes opera even in small towns. And it still goes on today in New York at the original Chautauqua site. So what I want to say today is this Chautauqua means adult education and I'd like to give you some education about war. In 1864, this was during the Civil War, we were also at war with the Indians in this country, the Native Americans. In Sand Creek, Colorado, Colonel John Shivington ordered his troops to attack a village of almost predominantly women and children and old people, in which 200 Arapaho and Cheyenne, mostly women and children, were massacred. Now, I don't want to read you the descriptions. You can look up Sand Creek Massacre and read the descriptions about that massacre. But I also want to bring in the other massacre more in our time, and that is My Lai. And this was at a time in the Vietnam War when I had yet to really fully realize how bad war was. But as you remember, Sergeant Callie and the infantry came into My Lai, a village of old people, children, and women, and massacred many of them. The thing that I want to tell you about both of those massacres is that there are heroes in war. There are heroes, even in the midst of massacres. In the Sand Creek Massacre, Captain Silas Sole and Lieutenant Joseph Kramer refused to order their men to fire and resisted the massacre at Sand Creek and testified later in a trial of John Shivington for the massacre, for which I knew that was going to happen. It's all right. I didn't know what was going to happen, obviously, or it wouldn't have. But so what I would like to say is we need adult education, we need to recover it, and we need to begin to teach our children early on what war is, the results of it, and who the real heroes are. Now, I'm not going to say that everyone who fights in a war, takes part in it, is a criminal, because that would be criminalizing my own brother. But I am going to say there are heroes that our children need to know about. In every single war, there are heroes who stand up for humanity, who stand up against massacres. It happened in the Korean Massacre, which is Picasso's most famous, one of the most famous paintings of Picasso, which is rarely seen in the United States. It happens in every war that people stand up and say no. And we need to begin to teach our children the real history of war, not simply with flyovers or trips to military bases. In Bloomington, Indiana, this past month, friends of ours who are in the Catholic worker community in Bloomington, you know what the Catholic worker communities are? They were started by Dorothy Day way back in the 1940s. They work with the poor, they live in community, and they stand for peace. There's now four families in the community at Bloomington. They take in people from prison, help them recover from drug addiction. But our friend who's a member of that community got a letter from her sixth grade student's teacher saying they were going on a field trip to the Crane Naval Weapons Base in Crane, Indiana. I grew up right beside that base. My dad and mother moved their family to Indiana in 1944 because of the coal strikes in Illinois. Pappy couldn't get work. So they moved to Odin, Indiana, and Pappy ran a bulldozer to help build the Crane Naval Weapons Depot, which is the largest naval base in the world. 66,000 acres of beautiful Indiana hill country. Committed to war. In fact, in their purpose mission statement, it says providing the tools for the war, for the soldier in war, providing the war fighter, providing tools for war fighters. And this young mother wrote her teacher, the daughter's teacher, and said, "My child will not be going on this." And I do not think it's a good idea to take children to go to military bases on field trips. And the teacher wrote back and said, I never thought about it. We were invited to do this by the naval base. Next year, I will turn it down. We need to quit teaching our kids to celebrate war. We need to quit teaching our kids that what the best thing, the heroes, be all you can be. Is that all we can be as war makers, war fighters? We need people to begin teaching children. And in order for that to happen, adults need to be aware of what war is and why it happens. In My Lai, it was Officer Hugh Thompson, helicopter pilot, who flew in support of the ground troops and saw the massacre taking place. And he ordered his pilot to, co-pilot to land and stay with the copter. He ordered his machine gunner to stay on his guns. And he walked down in along a trench and saw down in the trench 14 children and 3 women. And he asked a soldier in the Cowley's division, said, there is a trench over here with women and children in it. How can we get them out? And the soldier said, the only way to get them out is with a hand grenade. And Major Thompson ordered his machine gun to point the machine gun at the American soldiers around the ditch and said, if either of them raise the rifle, shoot them. And they pulled these children out, put them in their helicopter and the support helicopter behind them, and flew them out of the massacre. Sergeant Hugh Thompson suffered from PTSD, had severe psychological problems after that happened. He was also a Hoosier, by the way. There are heroes in war, but we teach our children the wrong heroes. We teach them the generals. We teach them to General George Scott, General George Custer, all these names that we give them in our history books. But we don't give them the names of Hugh Thompson, of Joseph Sole, or Joseph Kramer, or Silas Sole. Those are the ones. We at least ought to give them both. An education ought to give them both. Now, I think we live in, by the way, the most famous speech of a Chautauqua, I had a note on that I wanted to tell you. Most famous speech of Chautauqua history is called Acres of Diamonds. It was by a man named Russell Conwell. And in that speech, he said, get rich, young man, for money is power, and power ought to be in the hands of good people. I say you have no right to be poor. You have no right to be poor. And that's a fitting summation of the education that we give our children in America. You have no right to be poor. And in truth, it's a fitting association with the history of war, because war is the heartbeat of capitalism. And capitalism doesn't give you the right to be poor. It gives you the right to be rich if you're lucky. Memorial Day should be a day where we think seriously about who we are and who we want to be. And certainly we should honor those who have died. Honor those who have served. They didn't make the decisions to go to war. They didn't make up the lies, the misused intelligence that's now being summed up again for war against Iran as it was in Iraq. You know, I remember in 1980 thinking, it can't get any worse. And then in 2001, 2002, in the lead up to Iraq War, I said, surely it can't get any worse. It has gotten worse. And I should say to those who are maybe visitors to Unitarian Universalism and to this congregation, we have in our tradition the freedom of the pulpit. That is to say, the ministers have a right to speak the truth as they see it, but we also have freedom of the pews. You don't have to believe a word I say. We have no hell to send you to, so that's unfortunate. You know? It just doesn't work. So what we do is we try to speak our truth with some sense of justice and also mercy. Now, whence comes greatness? I think greatness comes from moral courage in perilous times. And we are living in perilous times, very perilous times. Not simply from the issue of war, but climate change, so forth. You know, we're living in a day where it has become obvious to me that perhaps the best thing that could happen to this planet is the disappearance of this species.
Really?
It would probably thrive without us. Life would be in abundance again without us. Species are going extinct on this planet at an alarming rate, in the sea, in the forest, all over. So what we need is moral courage in perilous times. And I want to talk about that a little bit. Merton said in his book, Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander, Thomas Merton, he has a statement in it that says, freedom, absolute freedom, the freedom to say one's own yes and one's own no, and not merely echo the yeses of state, church, society, or family, said freedom is inalienable to what it means to being a human being. And the absence of said freedom is the primary cause of the sickness of our society today. He wrote that in the 1960s during the Vietnam War. Freedom. That's what we say we're going to war for every time. World War II, the war to make the world safe for democracy. World War I, of course, is a war to end all wars. That worked real well. We went to Vietnam for freedom against so-called communism. We went to Grenada for freedom. We went to El Salvador, Guatemala, and every country in Central America for freedom. And don't take my word for it. Read the words of General Smedley Butler, the most decorated Marine general in history, who ended up being Secretary of Defense under Franklin Delano Roosevelt. In his book, Something of War, I'm trying to remember the title of it, it'll come to me in a minute. In his book about war, he said, we didn't fight. I didn't liberate Nicaragua for freedom. I liberated Nicaragua for Dole pineapple. I didn't invade Cuba for freedom. I invaded Cuba for United Fruit Company. I didn't invade these countries all again and again and again. We didn't do that for freedom. We did it for corporations. That's why we did it. That's why when after the Grenada invasion of Ronald Reagan's little war, when George Shultz landed down there, he said, what a great piece of real estate. What a great piece of real estate. And now we have a real estate man in the White House who goes to North Korea and says, what a great place for hotels, motels. This is what we're dealing with in America. What's it going to mean and what's it going to take to change that? Well, I like history. I study history a great deal. Philosophy and religion were my majors, but history has informed all of that. And I want to tell you a story now, which is a true story, absolutely true. It's so, you know, you'll realize that I couldn't have made it up or I'd be a million-dollar author. When I came back to Indiana in 1980, after leaving the parish ministry in Missouri, a large church out there, but my wife and I, Glenda, decided that we wanted to move back to a simple lifestyle, and I wanted to be a full-time parent, and I really respect all those people in this world who take full-time work and full-time pastorates and everything and still are good parents. I couldn't do it. I really found that I couldn't do it. I needed time to be a full-time parent and wanted to simplify our lives. It got very simple with 5 years in a teepee in Brown County, Indiana, and 14 years without electricity. And we lived for 14 years on less than $6,000 a year as a family because we were tax protesters because of war. So when I came back, I wanted to find out about the history of the Crane Naval Weapons Base, where I'd hunted mushrooms and deer hunted as a young man. And we'd grown up right beside this base, and I'd watch the jet fighters come down and dogfight over the base because it was a free flight area where you didn't have commercial flying. And I'd worshipped their flying and dreamed of being a Navy pilot. I got a book called Indiana at War out of the Monroe County Library and began to read about the history of the base and how the first 33,000 acres of that land was ceded to the state for a state park. And during the war, the Pentagon came in, the Department of Defense came in and condemned another 33,000 acres and took it over for a military base. And I learned that a whole holiness preacher that I knew as a child was our neighbor, that we used to go to revivals and hear him preach. He had gone to prison for 90 days for trying to move back into his house where that base now stands. And I learned that the Marines were brought in and that they bulldozed orchards and houses to keep people from moving back into their homes. That's how that base got there. We started doing protests at that base that year when we read this history. And when I was reading that history, I also found a book in the library, Monroe County Library, that had reports from the Bureau of Indian Affairs from their agents out in the West. And I haven't been able to get back and I'd like to get all the historical details and dates, but I haven't done that. But when I was thinking about this Memorial Day service or the Chautauqua, I wanted to tell the story. There was, back in the early part of the 20th century, there was a presidential campaign going on, as we've now gotten into these long presidential campaigns, and this one's already started. And so the president directed the Bureau of Indian Affairs to go out and register Indians so he could get more votes than out there in the Western country. So this agent went out to the Southwest to meet with Indians. And in his report, he begins it by saying, "I want you to know, I hereby state that I am of sober mind, that I have not been drinking, that what I'm about to tell you is exactly what happened." He said, my aides went out into the country to find the tribes. We met with them and called for a meeting of all the people in the area. And sure enough, they all showed up, and they all sat around in a big circle, and I set up my table out there, my desk, and we had registration books there, and of course, most of them couldn't write English or anything, but they could sign, make their sign, and we would authorize them as citizens. And so he got up to make his speech, and he was telling the people, "The great white father in Washington wants you to be citizens of the United States because he wants to be your great white father too. He wants to be your president." And they listened for a while, and finally one of them said, "Well, we've never had a president before. Why do we need a president? What's a president do?" "Well," the agent said, "the president does everything for you. President takes care of your children, educates them. The president will take care of your old people when they get old." Think of that. "The president will fight your enemies for you and protect you." And the elder native said, "Well, you know, we've always taken care of our children ourselves. And we've always taken care of our old people ourselves. And, you know, we've always determined who our enemies was and protected ourselves." But they said, "Maybe you're right. Maybe we haven't done such a good job." They said, "Give us 4 days. Give us 4 days and come back. We'll talk about it." And of course, Native people always send a voice in four directions, they say. To listen, to muse. By the way, the word muse goes back to a Latin word, which means putting your muzzle in the air. You know, my dog does that, sniffs the winds, reads the winds. So they were going out to muse, to send a voice in four directions, to listen. Do we need a president or do we not? They came back in 4 days, and the agent says, "This is precisely what happened. So they were all gathered around, and I got out my books out to have them sign, and I said, well, are you ready to become citizens? Do you want to have a president be your president too? And the elder of the tribe who had spoken before said, well, you know, we've been thinking about it for 4 days. And he said, one of our people remembered something. A long time ago, the animals called a big meeting, and all the animals came together. The meeting was called by the dogs. And the dog got up to speak, the lead dog, and the dog said, we need a president. And somebody said, well, why do we need a president? What's a president do? Well, the dog said, the president will protect your children, protect your old. President will protect all of you. That's what a president's for. And that we need a president, and the president ought to be strong and brave and fast, and we think it ought to be a dog. Well, an old owl sitting there says, well, maybe we do. Maybe we need a president. Give us 4 days. We'll think about it. So they come back in 4 days, and the dogs come panting in, and the lead dog just so excited said, are you ready to sign up? Are you ready to be president, to have a president? And he said, well, you know, we've been thinking about that. He said, maybe we do. Maybe we haven't done so well as we thought, and maybe we do. He said, yeah. The dog said, that's right. You do need a president. He ought to be brave. He ought to be strong. He ought to be fast. Dogs can do all those things. The owl said, sure. Yeah, the dogs are strong and brave and fast. That's true. And a president ought to have those qualities if he's going to be president. But he said, if a president is going to assume the kind of authority you're talking about over right and wrong, is going to do everything for us, make our decisions for us, define our enemies for us, if a president is going to take on that kind of authority, there's one more prerequisite that the president ought to have. The dog says, what is it? What is it? We can find a dog that'll meet it. I guarantee you we can find one. And I'll clean it up a little bit, although the agent didn't. The owl said, the president's feces should not emit foul odors. And that is why to this day, whenever two dogs meet, they always smell each other's behind. They're still looking for a president. Now, I want to go back to Merton. Because of what I want to say to you and what I say to anyone who would listen, what I say to my children when they were growing up, is you have to have the courage to say your own right yes and your own no. And that's what it means to be a human being. That's part of it. It's inalienable from being a human being, is that freedom. And that's the kind of freedom that I believe the United States or America or all these other names we have, that's the kind of freedom that's worth dying for. I don't think it's worth killing for. I want to be clear about my pacifism. Someone breaks into my house to attack my family, I would probably stop them in any way possible, even unto death. But I don't, you know, prepare for that. I figure, you know, I'm not going to live with that kind of fear. As J. Krishnamurti wrote in his book, The Education and the Significance of Life, which I found in the Greene County Library. It's a little book, about 80 pages. If you ever find it, pick it up. It's one of the top 5 books of my life. When I saw it in the Greene County Library when we were homeschooling our children, I bent over so I could see the binding of this little book, and it said, Education and the Significance of Life. I said, well, that's pretty damn presumptuous. In one little book? So I took it out. No one had ever checked the book out. And it became one of my most important books. But he says in there, the purpose of education is the elimination of fear. He also said in the West, he was the first person to bridge East and West, J. Krishnamurti, back in the early 60s. He said, in the West, you concentrate on teaching your children, teaching people what to think. In the East, we concentrate on teaching people how to think. Of course, that's changed with the spread of this rabid capitalism. We pretty much, you get this kind of stuff all over the world now. Teaching people how to think, how to say their own yes, and how to say their own no. That's what we need to be doing. And finally, there is a creation myth that forms my thinking more than any other. and it belongs to the Hopi. The Hopi natives in Arizona, in New Mexico and Arizona, they believe, they say they've been there for 25,000 years. The oldest community in North America are the Hopis. And there are archaeological studies now, we're beginning to realize that people are here a lot longer than we thought they were. They say that they were brought up from the bowels of the earth, from a hole in the ground on the Black Mesa. And were driven out through the Black Mesa. It's a very powerful place. They were brought up from a hole in the ground and released onto the face of the earth. And their guide from the underworld, before he released them onto the face of the earth, said to them, one last instruction. Go onto the face of the earth and discover what it means to be a human being. I believe that's all I'm about. I don't have any certainty. I have no idea what happens when you die. I'm not even worried about it. I'm worried about what happens when you fail to live. And live abundantly, not in terms of possessions, but in terms of love and courage. Go unto the face of the earth and discover what it means to be a human being. And we in America, the safest country in the world in many ways, who can invade America? We've never been invaded. Play Risk, that game, that military game. You can't lose if you got America. It's impossible. It's ridiculous. That game's a joke. We've never been invaded. But being a human being means having the moral courage and the education to eliminate ridiculous fears, like the fear of women and children coming in the southern border as being some kind of invasion and putting them in cages, like separating family because of our fears. America, it is time to wake up. It's time to wake up to who we are. And I tell you, you know, I love parades. I love to fly. I still look up when planes come over, even fighters, jet fighters. I love speed. I love games. But I'm telling you, I love life. And I believe that we can find the moral courage to stand in perilous times and say our own no and our own yes. And I believe that it's time for us to do it. Not for our sake, we don't have a whole lot left, but for the sake of our children for seven generations. Memorial Day should be a day to pray that it never happens again. Memorial Day should be a day to dedicate our lives to seeing that it does not happen again, that we will not sacrifice our children on the altar of war anymore. How absolutely blind arrogance it is to look back at earlier civilizations and say, oh, they sacrificed their babies. We sacrifice our babies. We just wait until they're 18 years old to do it. And it's time to stop doing it. It's time to quit spending $32 million an hour in order to kill people and start spending money to educate and give us health care. That's what time it is. $32 million an hour goes to the military budget. It is time to say our own yes and our own no. Now, I don't want to be a bummer the whole night. So, we're going to sing a song for you. And invite you to sing it with us. And had I got here early, as I wanted to, I practiced over there and plugged in, but I'm not going to. We're just going to do it.
So, we're not going to do the reading song?
Oh, I think we're going to do both of them. We got time for two songs?
Yeah.
Can I
just?
Yeah.
I'm not used to singing on a microphone.
You're not used to singing on a microphone, but you can sing.
I may have to get on my sunglasses.
Get on your sunglasses. You got that? So, the words up there in that thing. If you want to get them somewhere, if you think you need.
Can you hear me okay? Not on a microphone. When Barbara was talking earlier about, oh, what was it?
read and talking about Memorial Day and Decoration Day. My parents always called it Decoration Day. My daddy died 3 years ago. He was 90. My mom is still alive. She's 92. They'd been married 70 years at that time. And they called it Decoration Day. And they would go and decorate the graves of their parents on Decoration Day. My mom has not been feeling well the last couple of weeks, and I talked to her Friday, and she wasn't feeling well. Her voice was shaky. I could tell she wasn't feeling well. What she was worried about was whether or not she was going to be able to put flowers on Daddy's grave. Mm-hmm. And she talked to my brother, and he was going to get his daughter to go pick some up, and my younger brother was coming down from Carmel, and I got a picture on the way up here a while ago. I got a picture from my sister-in-law of my mom fixing the flowers on Daddy's grave. That was so important to her. Daddy was in World War II, but he never talked about it. He didn't ever want to talk about the war. And but he, they didn't like the idea of pacifism at all. Mm-hmm. Daddy didn't. But he did never want to talk about the war. And so this first song that Rona sang, I wrote when I was coming back from Mom and Dad's a couple of years ago, reading road signs all the way home from southeastern Indiana over near Vivi and Rising Sun in that area, if you all know where that is, back over to Spencer. And so I was writing down all the names of these, all these things on street
running signs. Trucks off the road as she did it, probably.
On road signs, on an envelope on the way home. Yeah, had a tune going in my head. And when Bill was talking about fear, the chorus says, "I'm alive and I'm well, ain't worried about hell." And I've got heaven busting out all around me. And so I think that really speaks to that idea of just being so intentional and so in the moment of noticing what's around us, of noticing the beauty, of noticing the people and the love and putting more of it out there. And so anyway, this song's kind of funny. You can sing along with the chorus if you pick it up. Now am I supposed to turn this one off? Or sing with it in my hand?
This is it.
Sing with it in my hand? Have I got it at a good distance?
Check.
Here?
Yeah, we can do that.
I'm not being too crazy. Okay?
Yeah.
I'm Glenda, by the way.
Yeah.
Bill and I celebrate our 50th anniversary this summer. So, we're going to go up in a hot air.
When we got married, I was a teenage holiness evangelist preaching at tent revivals. Her mom said I was an answer to prayer because she always wanted her daughter to marry a holiness preacher. And I tell her now, God's got a great sense of humor, doesn't he?
Straw hats, fly spray, and saddlebags, sweet corn, tomatoes, and beans. Jesus is coming soon. There's an auction at noon and a poster of the 4-H Queen. Yard sales, square bales, and fireworks, rabbits and chickens and straw. Holy Ghost, hog roast, God bless America, Boston vodka, strawberry ale.
I'm alive and I'm well, ain't worried about hell. Got heaven busting out all around me. Reading signs of all kinds, but the windows rolled down. Riding home on this Indiana highway.
Stop signs, yield signs, and detours. Bus stops and no passing stone. Farm sale, house to rent, road closed ahead. Paying top dollar for gold. Chrysanthemums, melons, and peaches. Zucchinis and blackberry jam. Brown eggs, $2. Old Avon bottles, never pay full price again.
I'm alive and I'm well, ain't worried about hell. Got heaven busting out all around me. Reading signs of all kinds, with my windows rolled down. Riding home on this Indiana highway.
Cold beer to go. Lay it down, let it go, let him in. Watch for ice on the bridge. School bus, turn around. Beware of Doberman antiques. Catfish on Friday. The Bible's most helpful when open. Pay teachers, say no to guns. Don't mow, don't spray. Children at play. Some things you gotta take a stand on.
Yes, some things you gotta take a stand on. Find a Bible, put your right hand on.
Pay attention to the signs. Read between the lines. Paint some daisies on the square that you land on.
I'm alive and I'm well. I ain't worried about hell. I got heaven busting out all around me. Reading signs of all kinds with the windows rolled down. Driving home on this Indiana highway. Reading signs of all kinds with my windows rolled down. Driving home on this Indiana highway.
That's the real easy one. Y'all can sing on the choruses, and there's a bridge in there somewhere that you might not want to cross.
Well, it's not the chorus. You can sing on every verse that.
That's right, every verse.
There are three verses. They're very similar. They're easy to pick up on.
You want to change one word?
Change word, and then we'll do a bridge that's a little different, and see if we can get through it. But please sing along.
If
the spirit moves you.
Easy.
Or,
it's
you know,
an easy.
Whatever. It's pretty easy. And I wrote this song. I visited a guy in prison at Pendleton. And I wrote this song after visiting him there one day when he was talking about trying to carry love and peace everywhere he was at the prison. At that time, I think he was at Wabash, but he was sent to Pendleton. But he was talking about, you know, even in a place like a maximum security prison, trying to carry love in his heart. And so that's why I wrote, that was my inspiration.
The man serving three life sentences, and he's a changed man. We don't have to be this mean. We don't have to be this cruel. One, two, three.
Carry love in your heart, in your hands, in your mind. Carry love every step that you take. Pass it out, pass it on, pass it all around the table. Carry love and give it away.
Carry joy in your heart, in your hands, in your mind.
Carry joy every step that you take. Pass it out, pass it on, pass it all around the table. Carry joy and give it away. In your heart, in your hand, in your mind. Carry peace in your step that you take. Pass it out, pass it on, pass it all around the table. Carry peace and give it away.
Pass it out and watch it multiply just like the loaves and fishes. Pass it on and watch it change the world like a smile of a little child. Pass it all around the table to your family, friends, and strangers. Pass it all around the world and watch it grow.
Carry love in your heart, in your hands, in your mind. Carry love every step that you take. Pass it out, pass it on, pass it all around the table. Carry love and give it away. Carry love and give it away. Carry love and give it away.
Thank you. It strikes me that if you're not carrying peace in your mind and in your heart, when you need it in your hands, it won't be there. If you're not carrying love in your hand, in your heart and your mind, when you need it in your hands, it won't be there. If you're not carrying joy in your heart and your mind, when you really need it in your hands, it won't be there. It's a good practice. Thank you very much. It's been an honor.
So we have time for some questions, and what we'd like is you raise your hand and wait for the microphone, because all of this is being taped, and so don't say anything you don't want your mother to hear. Yeah. It's going out on the internet.
I can pass that around.
And if you can't hear yourself when you're talking to the mic, move it a little closer to your mouth.
Don't be shy. Yeah, go ahead there.
I mean, you all were so good, I kind of...
Give us your name.
Jim Farrell.
Yeah, I thought it was Jim.
Yeah. Just your comment about, your comments about war. Being a Vietnam era person, I felt a little guilty about not going.
Mm-hmm.
And my Faye's father was a World War II veteran. And I've tried to raise conversations, and the first attempt, all I had to say was, the invasion of Normandy wasn't good for anybody, and I've got nothing to say.
Wow.
And on the second occasion, because of the Vietnam War era that we were in, I said, well, what the war you fought was a nobler war, because I'm hearing stories about fracking, where people are blowing up their commanding officers. And he said, well, I said, World War II must have been much nobler because there's no stories like that. And he said, well, we blew up our commanding officer in the latrine, and war is not good for anybody.
Let me respond to that just a bit. I think Howard Zinn, a longtime friend of mine, the author of The People's History of the United States, probably one of my highest honors to end up in that book. It's really surprised me. In 2001, I think it was, a student called from Denver wanting to talk to me about prison work that I was doing. And he said, well, I just read about you in Howard Zinn's People's History. And I said, no, you don't. I have a copy of that. I'm not in it. He said, well, you're in mine. It was in 1999 edition. I met Howard at the Pentagon at a protest in 1980, and he gave me his first edition copy of The People's History, which we taught our children. If you don't know that book, I recommend it. It's written from a point of view. All histories are written from a point of view. And this one is history from the people's point of view. And you'll learn more about the United States than you ever thought possible. But Howard had another speech that he made sometime just before his death about the fact that the real mistake we made in 1942, and he was a bombardier in World War II, the real mistake we made is to call that the Great War, because there was no Great War. And in fact, Howard was in the last bombing raid in a little town in France, and the war was basically over. European theater is basically, there were German soldiers there, but they were living outside. There was no fighting going on whatsoever. And they firebombed a little town in France for the sole purpose of testing napalm. It was the first time napalm was ever used, and that bombing run was simply a test of weapons. There was no military reason to do it. And Howard, being a bombardier, he was actually a socialist as a young man, but he went to fight in that war and was a bombardier. And later on, he said, you know, we bombed from 10,000 feet. We didn't see what happened. He said, about 1949, I started having nightmares, and the clouds and the smoke went away, and I began to see what happened. That's when he founded the World Peacemakers. And he flew to Vietnam with Dan Berrigan to get POWs out of a prison camp in Hanoi. The State Department tried to block their flight to keep them from going, but the North Vietnamese would only release their POWs to the peace community. And so they flew to Vietnam and brought the soldiers, the pilots home. The war is what can you say about it? War is hell. We've said that so many times throughout history. We read it all the time, and yet we continue to go to it. And, you know, Dwight D. Eisenhower, in his last speech to Congress, said the greatest threat to the American democracy is the military industrial complex, which is now taking over this country. And he also said the United States has the power to declare peace on the world and win, and that one of these days the people of the world are going to get so sick of war that the governments are going to have to get out of the way and let them have peace. And I think that's time is coming. And I think our young people are leading this. I'm not optimistic. I don't have enough evidence for being optimist, but I'm hopeful. And I think the young people are woke and better get ready because they're coming. Somebody else?
Bill, I'd like to ask a question.
Now, what's your name again?
Dave Cravat.
Dave.
So as I understand it, more than at least half of our tax dollars go towards funding military.
61%.
And also the United States military budget is greater than, say, the next 8 nations combined.
That's correct.
What do you think the reason is for that?
Money.
It possible that we could be, we manufacture weapons, we sell them to other countries to make money off of it?
No question. Smedley Butler's book, by the way, that I mentioned earlier, the name of the book is War is a Racket. War is a Racket. It just came to me. When you were talking about that, I said, racket. Right now, we are selling weapons to Saudi Arabia that they're using in Yemen. 87,000 children died of hunger in Yemen last year, and American weapons, made some of them right here in Indiana, are being used in Yemen. Sold to a country whose prince killed an American journalist and brutally killed him. I mean, killed is killed, but you can be, even the brutality of that nation is unbelievable. And so, war is always fought for good reasons. They never tell you we're just going to war to make money or we're just going to war to get rid of somebody. It's always for good reasons. And it's for no reason at all except money. And really, that's what's driving our economy. I make no bones about it. I'm a socialist. I became a socialist some years ago, a democratic socialist. It has nothing to do with the Soviet Socialist Republic. That was state capitalism. It wasn't socialism at all. It was dictatorships. I believe that every person born on this globe has an equal right to be here and equal access to the resources of this planet. And I will go to my grave fighting to make that happen. Capitalism is freedom to get rich for a few. And all you have to do is play Monopoly. I tell these people, I work with people, working class people all the time, who just think capitalism's wonderful. They can't pay their bills. They gotta have terrible health care, but it's wonderful. Wonderful for who? It's wonderful for the guy who wins Monopoly. Play the game. It was made as a satire. That book, a woman invented that game as a satire of capitalism. And I think, it is lifeblood. The war is its lifeblood. It can't live without it. If you go back and read The Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith, the father of modern capitalism, two things that stood out in that book to me is, number one, he said that no CEO or leader of a head of a corporation should ever make more than 15 times the lowest employee. We're 300 times now, or more probably. And he also said, a market without morality will destroy every other sector of an economy. And if we don't have a market without reality, I don't know what it is, without morality. No, it is reality. So, that's kind of where we're at. And, it can be depressing. That's why I think it's important to be together as a community, to build community, to work with people. And I live in Owen County. It's one of the most conservative areas. We get gunfire all around us all the time. I meet some of these people, as I have across the time, and when I ran for office. They're good people. They just haven't been told the truth. Somebody's got to tell them. Question?
Hi, Bill. I'm Jeff Haverly.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Do you know, I've not been keeping track and finding out information that I ask myself questions about. How much did Halliburton make? And where are they in profit and loss? and loss over the Iraq wars, because that was the first war I was ever aware of that there was such support from a private company.
Privatization, yeah. Well, they're privatizing everything from war to prisons to health care to everything. Yeah, Halliburton's right up there. I think it was I don't know the exact figures, but it was billions of dollars that they made off of the war when Dick Cheney was president. That was intentional. That was intentional. Yeah, he was chairman of Halliburton. He was president of the United States. We had a titular president in those days, yes.
I'm Ann Johnson. Would you care to speak to foreign aid as corporatism?
Yeah, you know, I grew up thinking that we fed the world. That's what we were told. We were small farmers. But you tell that all, you see it all the time, America feeds the world. How come people are starving to death everywhere if we're feeding? Every dollar of federal aid, foreign aid, that is given to foreign countries, American corporations make 90 cents off that dollar. 90 cents out of every dollar comes back to American corporations. And that's what people don't understand. They love, Rush Limbaugh and all of them love to read this Canadian that wrote this article on how generous America is. I've heard it so many times, I just gag. And the fact is, Americans are generous. They're very, I know people down here who are very, very conservative, but if a hungry child showed up at their door, I don't care where he come from or what color it was, they would feed him. And yet, they will support an administration that cuts education, that's kicked over several million children off of health care. There's support policies in our state in which our education budget is being cut, public education is being destroyed. We can't even give our children lunch anymore at school. I mean, when I went to school, you got rode the bus, you got lunch, you got snacks, you had recess. And my parents didn't pay anything for it. They paid taxes. That's what they were paying taxes for. Now, we get none of that. And so I think really we're seeing the collapse of the corporate estate. It's blamed on Mussolini. I can't find anywhere where Mussolini actually said it when he said, or is purported to have said, capitalism should be called corporatism because it is a marriage between the state and the corporation. And that's precisely what we have. And, we've had presidents who fought it. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and he was a capitalist, full-blown capitalist. The only reason he fought it, the only reason he said the rich are going to hate me, is because the socialists made him do it. And I ask people all the time, I say, why don't they call it capital security? If socialism's so bad, why did they call it social security? Well, the fact is, the socialists got us Social Security, got us a 40-hour work week, got us labor right to unionize, got us public education, got us women's right to vote. All those things came from the socialists. Eugene V. Debs, my favorite hero of Hoosier land from Terre Haute, Indiana, went to prison for standing up on the street in Ohio in a speech about World War I and saying this is nothing but a war for the corporations. And he was sent to prison by Woodrow Wilson, who said he would never take us into war, but did. Went to prison, federal prison, simply for saying those words under the Treason Act that they had passed for that purpose. He served 2 years in Atlanta federal prison and received 1 million votes for president as a prisoner in federal prison. And after Harding was elected, he got so much mail from all over the country demanding that he release Debs from prison, that he wrote Debs and said, I'll release you on Christmas Day of this year on one condition, and that is you come to the White House so I can meet you. Debs left the prison, went to the White House, had Christmas dinner with President Harding, got on a train, came back to Indianapolis. They stopped the train because Terre Haute wasn't ready. On December 27th, 1921, middle of winter, no airplanes, no interstates, 50,000 people met Eugene V. Debs' train in Terre Haute. 50,000. And it was a picture on the front of the New York Times, 50,000 people. He couldn't even walk to his house. They carried him because there was no place for him to stand. Indiana was not always the backwater of right-wing radicalism. It was a leader in so many things in the early 1920s. The agricultural movement, the farmers' union, the railroad unions, all these things came out of that socialist movement. And Social Security, which I'm glad they call it Social Security, because I'm on it. And if they try to take it away, maybe my generation will wake up. I don't know. But yeah, war's the racket. That's the way it is. Anybody else? Thank you all very much. It's an honor to speak. I feel honored anytime people are willing to listen. And the one thing I never have, and I do not expect to ever have, is certainty. I could be wrong about a lot of things, but seek it out for yourself. Certainty is pretty dangerous, I think. Thank you.